Hello, this is the Physics 100 lecture for October 24th, 2007. If you've not downloaded the PDF file to accompany this lecture, you should do so now. On page 1 of the PDF file, you see a picture of the Fermilab high-rise. Fermilab is Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory just outside of Chicago. And it's the site of the highest energy particle accelerator in the world right now. The picture on the lower right shows you the footprint of the accelerator structures from the air. At any rate, that's where I am this week. And we'll talk a little bit about Fermilab and the accelerator a little later in the semester, but not today. So if you go to slide 2, remind you what we did last time. Last time we discussed quantum uncertainty, and in particular the new thing we did was discussion of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. There are different forms for Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. The most common form that you see is written on the top equation. It says delta x times delta p is roughly h. If you recall, h is Planck's constant, which is an extraordinarily small number. I mean, something like 10 to the minus 34. Delta x represents the uncertainty in the position of any measurement you might make, a position of a particle, for example. And delta p represents the uncertainty in its momentum if you try to make a measurement. And what this particular principle tells us is that you cannot measure both the position and the momentum of a particle to arbitrary precision. It basically says if you measure the momentum very precisely, then your uncertainty in the position is very large. If you measure the position very precisely, your uncertainty in the position and the momentum is very large. And this strikes us as very strange because this isn't the world that we grew up. This isn't the world we grow up in, basically. This isn't something we have to consider whenever we try to ascertain the position and momentum of a running back coming toward us if we're playing football, for example. And the reason for this is that this really is important for very small things and very precise measurements. It doesn't really make any difference otherwise. But in the world of the subatomic world, that becomes essential. Another form of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, before I go to the second equation. This first equation basically says goodbye to the deterministic universe. Up until this point, as we have been talking, if we were to input all of the information about particles, we knew their exact positions and their velocities or their momenta and the forces that they experience at the time, we could calculate the future of the universe. We basically grow up believing in the deterministic universe. That's the Newtonian universe. That goes out the window with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. You can no longer know everything about the state of a particular particle. You cannot know its position and momentum to arbitrary precision, which means you have inherently some uncertainty in any calculations that you might make about the future. So Wall Street really doesn't need to worry. At any rate, if we go to the second equation on page 2, another form of the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle says that delta E times delta T is roughly a small number. And that says the uncertainty in the energy of a system times the uncertainty in the time over which it exists is equal to a small number. A way to think about that is I can violate conservation of energy so long as I do it for a very, very short time. And that's sort of the most useful way to think about this one. And that, again, is completely wacky from our point of view because what I just said is I could be standing right in front of you in Hoyt Hall and I could make a Volvo appear right in front of me, and it could disappear. And so long as it appeared and disappeared over during such a very short time that no one could notice it, it doesn't make any difference. It could happen by quantum mechanics. So that sounds pretty crazy, but the implications of this are absolutely tremendous. And we will talk a lot about that as the course goes on. This form of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle really does give us a loophole in energy conservation, which leads to our understanding of the fundamental essence of forces in quantum mechanics. The formalism that describes this is known as quantum field theory, which is really the mathematical treatment, or the theory that is most successful in physics today. It is behind what we call the standard model of particle physics, which has held true for almost anything we have measured to huge numbers of decimal places. And we'll talk a lot about the standard model of particle physics. So we'll come back to this, but quantum uncertainty really determines a lot about the universe in which we live. So let's go on to slide 3. Let's think a minute about where we've been on our journey so far in this class. To me, a lot of what this class is about is to try to answer the question of what are we made of? I mean, that's sort of where my scientific interest in the world began. And if you were to take a chunk of some sort of crud and start splitting it with a razor blade into lots of little thin lines or lots of little pieces or whatever, and you split it up into something as small as you could get, you basically would find the atom. And we've learned about the basic structure of the atom. It's, you know, roughly 10 to the minus 9-ish meters in size. We have negative electrons. And then in a very small region in the middle of it, we have a nucleus, which is positively charged. The size of the nucleus is about 10 to the minus 15 meters. So I consider the atom to be sort of layer one in the onion of inner space. I mean, you can sort of imagine that if we were to take a trip into inner space, trying to probe down to see what the nature of matter happens to be, you can imagine that it's an onion and that we basically are peeling away layers as we probe deeper and deeper into smaller and smaller structures. And so, to me, layer one is the atom. Layer two is the structure of the atom. So once you have the atom, you can talk about elements and this stuff, but then if you want to understand the atom, you have to dig down into layer two, which is you begin to talk about nuclei and electrons. And so that's where we are now. What I'd like to do next is to think about layer three, which is to look inside the nucleus, to figure out what makes the nucleus click. And this, then, is the realm of nuclear physics. Now, I want you to say the word nuclear. Please never say the word nuclear. It makes me go absolutely bananas. We happen to have presidents, Jimmy Carter and our current president, who seem to be incapable of actually pronouncing the word nuclear. Jimmy Carter had no excuse. He was actually a nuclear engineer in the Navy. George Bush, well, maybe his excuse was too many parties when he was young. I don't know. At any rate, to me, it is extraordinarily embarrassing to have presidents who have their finger on the button and can't even pronounce the word. Having said that, you're educated people, and if you get nothing else out of Physics 100, I would like you to get out of it the proper pronunciation of the word nuclear. We are looking at nuclear physics, not nuclear physics. All right, I'll get off my soapbox now. At any rate, we, in learning about the atom, have talked about how the nucleus is made up of Z protons, each of which has a positive charge, and A minus Z neutrons, so that means we have A protons and neutrons in the nucleus. And the neutrons are neutral. The atom is rounded out by Z electrons, basically in the region of space surrounding the nucleus and attracted to it by the Coulomb force. Since there are Z protons of positive charge and Z electrons of negative charge, the net charge on a standard atom is zero. Okay, now, you may wonder how in the world we know that there is a nucleus and that it looks like this. And the answer isn't really, it's not intuitive. If you go to slide 4, you could ask, for example, we're familiar with the Bohr model of the atom, but an essential piece of the Bohr model of the atom is you have this tiny nucleus with the electrons circling around it. How did Bohr know to treat the nucleus as a small central part? I mean, it doesn't necessarily make any sense. He knew because he had spent time in the lab of Ernest Rutherford, who was a New Zealand farm boy who moved to England. And Rutherford and his students actually established experimentally the nuclear model of the atom. And at the time, way back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there were two possibilities, really, for the structure of the atom. The one that was probably the simplest in terms of what people at the time could imagine is known as the plum pudding model, and it was one of the main advocates was J.J. Thompson at Cambridge. The plum pudding model, you can imagine an atom looking something like I signify at the bottom right of page 4, where I have the pink circled B. What people knew was that, and we'll talk about how they did this a little bit, but what they knew was that you could kick an atom and manage to get out electrons with negative charges and protons with positive charges. They knew the atom was made up of the two. They understood how negative and positive things attracted each other. So they figured that there was some stable configuration of negative and positive charges in the atom. They also understood that if you jiggled a net charge, like a negative charge, that it would emit light. And they knew that atoms could emit and absorb light. So a model that made a lot of sense would be to have the atom be sort of a smeared out cloud of positive charge with little negative electrons scattered around in such a way that the positive charge and the negative charge sort of attracted itself and was sort of in a stable configuration. And then light could be emitted by the electrons basically jiggling back and forth a little bit. And so this is sort of the idea. It met with some troubles because it was not possible to create a model like this such that only discrete colors of light would be emitted or absorbed in the same way that you get out of the Bohr model. So it didn't work really well, but in principle this was sort of the simplest idea that people thought about. The idea that came out of Rutherford's lab, who was in Manchester at the time, was the nuclear model. And the nuclear model is basically what you're familiar with that we've been talking about. And so Bohr picked up the idea from Rutherford, and how did Rutherford get it? Well, if you go to slide 5, What Rutherford did was Rutherford had a natural, used a natural radioactive source. If you look at lower left of slide 5, where I have a circled pink C, there was known to be naturally radioactive substances that would emit heavy charged particles called alpha particles. And what an alpha is, we'll talk about in a little while, but just think of it as it is basically just a cluster of two protons and two neutrons. It's a helium nucleus that some atoms will naturally emit. And that had been discovered, and basically Rutherford used it like a gun. He bombarded, if you look at the bottom diagram, he had alphas being emitted in all directions from an alpha source, and he had the alphas bombard a thin gold foil located at point D, the circle, the pink D in a circle. And he looked to see how the alpha particles scattered as they went through the gold. He looked at the distribution of the scattering. And the way that he and, well, his students observed it is that alpha particles, when they hit a thin sheet of something known as zinc sulfide, where I have the pink E circled, the zinc sulfide actually glows a tiny bit when an alpha particle goes through it. It basically, the atoms of zinc sulfide get excited by the charged particle passing nearby. And by excited, I mean that the electrons either get knocked out or moved up to higher energy levels, and then they cascade down emitting light. And when they do, that light is visible, and you can actually see where the alpha particle hits the zinc sulfide. So Rutherford's students could look at the zinc sulfide detector and count the number of hits in different locations to determine the distribution of scattering of the alpha particles off of the gold foil. To get an idea of how this might tell you something about the structure of the atom, if you look in the upper right of slide 5, the plum pudding model, where we have a smeared out positive charge region with negative charges also distributed evenly throughout, if the blue lines represent alpha particles, what you have is basically a smeared out distribution, and the alpha particles are basically going to go through it. They may be deflected a tiny bit as they pass through this, but it's not going to do much to the alpha particles. If you consider the nuclear model, where I have the pink A circled in the upper left of slide 5, most of the time the alpha particle is going to pass right through the atom without getting very close to the nucleus, and it will not be deflected very much. But once in a while, the alpha particle is going to be headed straight at the nucleus, and the Coulomb repulsion from the nucleus, which can be very big for gold, in fact, it's huge. There's something like, 79 protons, I think, in gold. And in the gold nucleus, so it's a charge of plus 79 in the nucleus. If the alpha particle comes anywhere really close to it, it's going to get the crap knocked out of it. It's going to basically be deflected at a very large angle. And this is what Rutherford and his students observed. They saw that they got, most of the time, alpha particles passed right through the foil without being deflected, but once in a while they got these absolutely huge deflections. And when they calculated the distribution of these deflections, what they found was they could only describe it by assuming a nuclear model where all of the charge of the nucleus was condensed into this very small region, about 10 to the minus 15 meters in size. And this is the origin of the nuclear model of the atom. And if this seems a little bit strange to you, let me try an analogy to give you some sense of how this works. Go to slide 6. You could imagine this alpha source as basically being a high-powered rifle, shooting these alpha particle bullets at the atom. And imagine what would happen if you know, I gave you, you'd never seen a car before in your life, and I gave you a car, and you needed, I asked you to determine where most of the mass of the car existed. You know, how was the mass distributed in the car? But you couldn't open it and look in it or anything like that. Well, one way to do it might be to take the car and park it out someplace and then get a high-powered rifle with lots of bullets and start shooting the car, basically. And what you would notice is that you would get bullets scattering differently depending on how much mass they encountered or how the mass was distributed in the car. For example, if you shot the car in the windows or in the doors, the bullets would basically just pass right through the car. But if you shot the car in the region where the engine happens to exist, those bullets would ricochet. And so this analogy is basically what Rutherford saw. If you could imagine the engine condensed into some small ball in the middle of the car someplace, you could literally, with thousands of bullets, map out the distribution of where that heavy mass happens to be. So this was the game that Rutherford and his students played and Bohr was privy to, which is why we have the nuclear atom. And this is pretty solid work. So we know we have a nucleus in an atom. Now, if you go back to slide 3 and you look at the bottom of this slide, the nucleus has Z protons and some neutrons that are neutral, all crammed into a little ball that's about the size of 10 to the minus 15 meters in size. What's wrong with this picture? If you were to calculate the Coulomb repulsion between the protons when they are that close to one another, you would find the Coulomb repulsion is absolutely huge. The nuclear model of the atom makes no sense whatsoever. The nucleus should blow apart. Yet, science is driven by experiments, okay? And nature has told us, through experiment, that indeed we do have a nuclear model and all these protons are crammed into this little ball. So we have a real problem based on what we know, because we do understand Coulomb's force and we know that repulsion to be present and large. So something has to hold the nucleus together. If you go to slide 7, well, I guess I meant to go to slide 7 a minute ago. Here we have the picture of the nucleus with all these protons crammed into some small little area. And the picture is absolutely whack. Nucleus should blow apart, but it doesn't. So what's in the nucleus is a valid question, and what holds it all together? So now let's go to slide 8. Well, how do we know the proton is in the nucleus? Well, Rutherford and his people actually discovered the proton, and they discovered the proton as being a component of atoms by, again, using alpha source as a little gun and shooting atoms, in fact, nitrogen gas, and when an alpha particle hits nitrogen, sometimes it can actually kick out a proton. And they were Rutherford and his crowd were able to characterize the protons coming out. They were able to characterize the mass and the charge of the protons. And this is how they determined the protons are inside atoms. The mass of the proton is 1 AMU, which is what we sort of call the mass of a proton or a neutron. It's more or less one atomic mass unit. This is just a convenient unit for talking about atomic masses. Okay. In terms of units that we've discussed in the past, The proton has a mass of 938 MeV over C squared. If you wanted to know what this is, I mean, you can look it up in a book, the conversion from kilograms to electron volts. It's an MeV is a million electron volts. So it's a very small number in terms of kilograms, not very convenient to use because it's a 10 to the minus whatever. It's so it's easier to talk about it in terms of when we talk about particle energies, particle masses, we tend to use electron volts, in particular thousands or millions of electron volts. 1,000 electron volts would be a keV. A million electron volts is an MeV. The charge of the proton is plus 1. To compare the size of a proton to an electron, or the mass at any rate, the mass of an electron is about a half an MeV. So the proton is almost 2,000 times heavier. We have talked a tiny bit about the fact that there is this strange characteristic that particles have, which is called spin. And the proton spin is actually the same as that of an electron. It's spin one-half, and that means the protons are fermions, and this can be very important in terms of trying to understand how protons interact. If we go to page 9, the neutron is also known to be a component of the atom. And this was discovered by Walter Botha and Becker in Germany, and James Chadwick. Well, yeah. Botha and Becker discovered a form. They did the experiment up at the top, which was, again, using the alpha gun. The alpha is hitting a very light element like boron or lithium. Something came out which happened to penetrate through things like walls, okay, and could expose film. That was what was discovered in Germany. And then James Chadwick in 1932 showed that penetrating radiation, which people had actually thought were gamma rays, or many people thought were gamma rays up until that time, Chadwick showed that, in fact, that penetrating radiation was not gamma rays, but had a mass close to that of the neutron, and the thing was uncharged. So Chadwick is given credit for discovering the neutron. The mass of the neutron is very close to that of the proton. That's 940 MeV over C squared. Again, about 2,000 times heavier than the mass of the electron. The electric charge of the neutron is zero. Similar to the neutron and the electron, similar to the proton and the electron, the neutron has a spin of one-half. So let's go to slide 10. Well, we have discussed the fact that the model of the nuclear model of the atom really makes no sense because we have all this positive charge crammed in such a tiny area, tiny volume. And this is one of those cases where there's no easy answer. Clearly, something new is involved here. And, in fact, this something new has to be a force which holds the nucleus together, and it has to be a force that is extraordinarily strong because it has to counterbalance and hold the nucleus together in the face of the tremendous Coulomb repulsion that exists between the protons and the nucleus. This new force was hypothesized, and because physicists are just so creative, it was given the name strong nuclear force. So, the strong nuclear force is a very bizarre force. in the strong nuclear force, it isn't present unless the particles are very close together. So, for example, if I were to take two guns that shoot protons, and I had aimed them at each other and shot them simultaneously, and had two protons coming toward each other at very high speed, what those protons would feel would be the force of Coulomb repulsion, the electric repulsion between the positive charges coming closer together. It would slow them down as they came toward each other. Suppose I shot them hard enough that they continued to move toward each other, even though they slowed down and there was this tremendous force pushing them apart. The strong nuclear force is a very strange force that just doesn't exist until the protons get within about 10 to the minus 15 meters of one another. And then that force acts like a strong glue that all of a sudden just sucks them together. Okay? That's the picture of the strong nuclear force that it should have. This is a force that just kicks in at a certain small distance for particles like protons and neutrons. For some reason, the electron doesn't even feel it. This we'll talk about later when we get to particle physics. But so that's the game. We have a new attractive force that kicks in at a very small distance that protons and neutrons feel. That's the hypothesis of what holds the nucleus together. Now, it turns out that we have protons and neutrons that are tiny particles, which means they have wavelengths. And in order to understand how the protons and neutrons are distributed and interact with each other inside the nucleus, you have to solve Schrodinger's wave equation for these tiny waves in this small region under the influence of a very strong spherically symmetric force called the strong nuclear force. So people do this, and when you do this, you find that you get the nucleons, and nucleon is a word that we use collectively for protons and neutrons. The nucleons get distributed in discrete energy levels just like the electron does in the attractive, in the region where there's the attractive force of Coulomb, electric attraction, the nucleons are distributed in an attractive, in a region of space in the nucleus where there's this very strong attractive force. The electrons are distributed in a region of space where there's an attractive force, which is the Coulomb force of attraction because of the positive charge of the nucleus. In both cases, when you solve Schrodinger's equation, what comes out of it are discrete available states that these waves, these particles, can populate. You've already seen what it looks like for the atom. It turns out there's a very similar thing for the nucleus, but instead of the electron occupying the discrete energy states, you have the nucleons populating the discrete energy states of the nucleus. So we have nuclear orbitals or nuclear quantum states inside the nucleus that are occupied by the neutrons and protons. And this is a little bit why I started out today talking about the onion structure of matter. Because it's as if the layer gets duplicated a little bit. The kind of thing that we saw with the atom is sort of what we're seeing inside the nucleus. So if we go to slide 11, we can imagine, in solving Schrodinger's equation, that there are a series of discrete states, which I show graphically where I have the pink A circled and the pink B circled in the upper left part of slide 11. And the protons and neutrons each populate their particular available energy levels in much the same way that electrons populate the energy levels in an atom. And remember our analogy of how the energy levels or the quantum states are basically like houses or condos along the incline of a ski resort slope, and all the electrons come piling out of a bus at the bottom and then go up to a condo, working their way up the mountain. We have exactly the same thing in the nucleus. And just like in an atom, you can have an excited state. So if you look where I have the pink A for the protons, if they fill the lowest energy state being E1, E2 being the next highest, E3 being the next highest, and so forth, you could imagine having a nucleus which is actually excited, where one of the protons is in a higher energy state. And it can cascade down into a lower energy state. I show it happening from some higher energy state down to E3. And in doing so, emits a photon of light, which has an energy that is exactly equal to the difference between those energy levels. That photon of light, in this case, has a frequency that corresponds to that energy difference. And it turns out to be in the gamma ray region of the spectrum. So nuclear quantum transitions or happen in the gamma ray region of the spectrum. And what you have seen, remember that I had the little lamps made up of gas of different elements that I could turn on, and you could look through the gratings and see the discrete colors of light emitted by the different types of atoms. If you could see gamma rays, you would see the same thing for light that is emitted and absorbed by the nuclei instead of the electrons. So this turns out to be incredibly important for us. If you look in the middle left of slide 11, you can see where I have graphical sketch of the atom, a nucleus with an electron around it. If you wanted to remove this electron, suppose you had something I'll just call ultra tweezers, you know, you could reach in and just grab a hold of an electron and pull it out. It would take a certain amount of energy to do that, okay? And we call that energy the ionization energy. It's basically the amount of energy that is tied up in binding that electron into the atom. It takes on the order of, and I have written in near that pink C something that says ionization O, and then in parentheses 10 EV. The O, 10 like that, is a way that physicists say on the order of. They mean approximately. Okay, the ionization energy for electrons out of atoms is roughly 10 eV, tens of eV electron volts. Okay, that's sort of a scale of the energy it takes. If, on the other hand, you go to the upper right and you ask about the same thing, where we take our ultra tweezers, but now we go inside a nucleus and we grab one of the nucleons, either a proton or a neutron, and we try to remove it from the nucleus. Then it takes on the order of a million electron volts to remove that nucleon from the nucleus. Note this huge difference. What that means is that the energy levels that you see in the upper left, the difference between those energy levels is on the order of millions of electron volts, whereas the difference between the energy levels in the atom is on the order of electron volts. This is why when you have transitions in the nucleus, you kick out photons that have tremendous energies, gamma rays, extremely energetic, and if you do the same thing for the atom with the electron making a transition, the light that comes out, the photons, have energies on the order of visible light, which is much less energetic. Think about this a little bit, okay? An atomic chemical reaction happens when I take a pile of atoms and I put them together with others, and the electron structure changes its configuration. in doing so, I'm making changes in a structure where the changes gain you or lose you on the order of electron volts to tens of electron volts. If this happens, and you're using, you know, TNT, for example, and you light it with a match, okay, when what's happening is you have lots of atoms rearranging themselves and releasing on the order of tens of electron volts each. If that happens fast enough, you get an explosion, okay, and it goes boom. If I do the same thing with nuclei, and I put nuclei together, and I have them reconfigure their nuclear configurations, the amount of energy that gets released per nucleus is on the order of millions of electron volts. And that's a whole lot bigger than the tens of electron volts. And that is why if you take nuclei and you manage to make those reconfigure themselves, you get a great big kaboom and you can vaporize a city as opposed to vaporizing a small room. That's the difference between nuclear power and chemical power. Okay? So nuclear reactions release about a million times more energy than you get out of chemical reactions. All right, so let's go to slide 12. All right, so I'd like to talk a bit about nuclear structure now. We've talked about atomic structure. Let's look at the nucleus. Since I have A meaning something on this particular slide, I've chosen to indicate positions using Roman numerals in pink circles. So if you look at Roman numeral 1 in the upper left-hand side, what I have drawn there is a generic symbol for a nucleus. The symbol X is the atomic element symbol. It actually gets specified by the number of protons in the nucleus itself. It's determined by Z. There's a one-to-one mapping between Z, which is the number of protons in the nucleus, and the element. Hydrogen is symbolized, has one proton, and is symbolized by a large capital H. Helium has two protons, and is symbolized by capital H, little e. Argon, etc. So it goes on and on. Oxygen, I think. Carbon has 12 protons and is symbolized by a C. Oxygen has 16 and is symbolized by an O. Okay. There are also some number of neutrons, which I have signified by N at the lower right of the symbol, the nuclear symbol at the top of the page. A is called the atomic mass. In atomic mass units, it's basically the number of protons plus the number of neutrons. Now, we've talked about how the number of protons, neutrons have a mass of 940 MeV over C squared, and protons have a mass of, 938 MeV over C squared. We basically say they each have a mass of just one atomic mass. And so A just represents the number of protons plus the number of neutrons. Since the protons and the neutrons are both about equivalent in mass and both about 2,000 times heavier than an electron, the mass in an atom is all in the nucleus. The electrons really don't add much, so A really does sort of represent the mass of the atom or the nucleus. Okay. All right. Now we have talked about how these nucleons populate different discrete nuclear energy levels that you get out of Schrodinger's equation. What this means is that you can have, for example, down where we have Roman numeral 2 in a pink circle, you can have a nucleus in an excited state. So that means that one of the nucleons is in one of the higher energy states, and in principle it can now cascade down into a lower energy state and emit a photon. I have drawn such a reaction where I have the pink Roman numeral 2. I have a nucleus with atomic symbol X, so that's just a fictitious generic symbol, okay? And I signify with a star that I have an excited state. So this asterisk on the upper right of that symbol is an excited state. So I'm basically saying one of the nucleons is in some high energy state. If a nucleus is set up that way, in many instances, that nucleon will naturally cascade down. And when it does, it will create the same nucleus, because I haven't changed Z, I haven't changed A, I haven't changed the number of neutrons or protons. All I've done is taken one of them and put it down in a lower energy level. So the atomic symbol stays the same, except now the nucleus is no longer excited. In addition to that nucleus now, there's a photon that gets emitted, which I symbolized with the symbol gamma. And it's a gamma ray because of the energy difference between nuclear energy levels. If you were to calculate the color or the frequency of a photon that's emitted with an energy of millions of EV, it's going to be in the gamma ray region of the spectrum. So, in fact, this is called gamma radiation. So, just like we can have excited states of atoms or molecules where the electrons cascade down and emit light, we can have the same thing with nuclei where the light happens to be in the gamma ray region of the spectrum. It turns out that there are nuclei in nature which are naturally found in an excited state, and they naturally have some probability of decaying in this way. And we would call that type of nucleus a naturally radioactive nucleus. And if you have a pile of this stuff sitting in your hand, if you could see gamma rays, you would basically see it glowing gamma rays. Not all of the nuclei go at once. There's a characteristic time scale it takes for each individual nucleus to decay, and sometimes that time scale is very, very long. So basically, every now and then, one of those nuclei decay, and you get a gamma ray coming out. So this is a form of natural radioactivity. Let's go to slide 13. A naturally radioactive substance is where the nucleus is unstable. Now, by unstable, what I really mean is it will naturally decay, but it could be sort of quasi-stable in the sense that that decay could take a very long time before it happens. All right? Now, because these energy differences are so huge, and we have from Einstein E equals mc squared, which I've written with the pink circle A, there's this sort of energy mass equivalence, and we're talking about differences in energy of millions of electron volts between the levels in the energy levels in nuclei, which means nuclei are capable not only of emitting light in a de-excitation, they're actually able to emit particles as well. So you can have other forms of naturally occurring radiation. One is called beta radiation. And in beta decay, if you look where I have the pink B circled, you have a nucleus, which I will give a generic symbol of X prime, which has A neutrons plus neutrons plus protons and Z protons, okay? And it can decay. Note the arrow going down to the lower left of this nucleus X prime. It can decay into a nucleus that has A protons plus neutrons, but one of the neutrons has changed into a proton. So if you look where I have C in a circle, you could have a neutron actually change into a proton plus an electron. And note that I have something neutral going into something that's positive and something negative. So what you have is conservation of charge. This process can happen inside a nucleus. And when it does, the electron comes out of the nucleus, leaving behind this extra proton, where one of the neutrons has changed to a proton. Since one of the neutrons has changed to a proton, the sum total of protons and neutrons has not changed, but the number of protons in the nucleus has actually increased by one. So you have now a new nucleus, and I have a new atomic symbol, X, instead of X prime. So if you look at D, we have a symbol X instead of X prime because I have a different number of protons. I now have Z plus 1. But the atomic mass is the same as what we had earlier with X prime. This is an example of beta decay, and the electron now comes streaming out of the sample in much the same way that gamma would for an atom that decays via gamma radiation. We do have a twist. If you look over where I have capital E in a pink circle, you could have inside a nucleus the proton changing to a neutron and releasing a positively charged electron, which is actually our first antiparticle, I guess. It turns out that for every particle there can exist the antiparticle, which has the opposite charge. And this is something where Star Trek is real, okay? It turns out antimatter is real. And there are substances where the positron, which is what we call this anti-electron, comes streaming out of the substance. And this is a case where a proton inside the nucleus changes into a neutron plus the positron. So now if we look where we have the E in the pink circle, I have a nuclear substance with an atomic symbol X prime, A protons plus neutrons, and Z protons goes into Z minus 1 because a proton has disappeared and changed to a neutron. The sum total of protons and neutrons is the same, so A does not change, but the number of protons has changed, so the atomic symbol changes as well. This is also a form of beta decay. It just emits a positron instead of the electron. Finally, if you look down at the bottom, where I have the F in a circle, you can see, again, some nuclear species, naturally radioactive substance with the symbol X prime, has A protons plus neutrons, Z protons. It can decay into another substance, G, in a pink circle, which has an atomic symbol X, but now has two fewer protons and two fewer neutrons. And the particle that gets emitted, I circled in pink, is called the alpha particle. And the alpha particle is a tiny nucleus in and of itself, consisting of two protons and two neutrons. If you actually look at different elements, this turns out to be the helium nucleus. And this is known as the alpha particle, which we've discussed already as being the bullets that Rutherford used. And this is known as alpha radiation. This process is known as alpha decay. Gamma decay, beta decay, and alpha decay are the three types of naturally occurring radiation in the world. Let's stay for a moment on slide 13. The substances that are emitted, the gamma ray, that's light, very high energy light. The beta ray, that's an electron or a positron, it's charged but very low mass. And an alpha particle, which has very massive compared to the electron and has twice the charge. These three things interact with matter in very different ways, and they pose different dangers. So, for example, if you have an alpha source outside your body, alpha particles tend to come out with not that much energy, and because they have a heavy charge, it turns out that they can't penetrate matter very well. They don't go very far. They won't go through your skin. So an alpha source outside of your body is actually not all that dangerous. A gamma source, on the other hand, gamma rays are very penetrating, and so gamma rays, like X-rays, can more or less just go right through you. Some of them will interact in your body, so a gamma source outside of your body is really rather dangerous. This reverses if you want to drink a glass of water laced with one of these sources. If you drink a gamma source, most of the gammas that are emitted by the nuclei in that substance that you drank go right through you. You basically glow gamma rays, but most of them aren't going to interact in your body, so it's not all that bad compared to some other things. But if you were to drink something that has an alpha source in it, it turns out that the alphas then would be inside your body where they would actually cause chemical damage to your cell structures and be a very serious problem. So where radiation safety is concerned, you have to be thinking about what is the particular nucleus involved and what does it emit and how does that gets emitted interact with nature. Okay, let's go to slide 14. Let me take just a moment to decide where I want to stop for this lecture. So, okay. I see that what I would like to do, hold on, so I have to make a modification in this page that I'm going to send out to you. Okay, go to slide 14. The different nuclei have different numbers of protons and neutrons. That means they have different so-called nuclear shell structures or different energy levels that are available for the protons and neutrons. You can have stable nuclei where basically once this nucleus is sitting there, it's not going to go anywhere and it's a stable structure. Everything is at the lowest energy level that it can go at. And so most nuclei are stable. Many nuclei are naturally radioactive. They're all different, and what this means is they can emit different types of radiation, and they have different levels of stability, which means a naturally radioactive nucleus has some probability of decaying. But remember how quantum mechanics works. You never know quite when that thing's going to happen. Could happen today, could happen 1,000 years from now. So it turns out that if I have a sample of 1,000,000 of them sitting in front of me, I can figure out how many of them will decay per day. All right, and so there's this characteristic decay time that each type of nucleus has, each type of naturally radioactive nucleus. We characterize this decay time with something known as the half-life, or T1/2, if you look where I have the circled pink A. The half-life is the amount of time it would take for half of the nuclei in any given sample to decay away. So if I started out with a gram of a substance sitting in front of me, I could keep track, and when I have a half gram of that substance left and all the other nuclei have decayed, I would have it one half-life in time would have passed. We say that a substance has a high activity, if you look down toward the bottom of slide 14, if you have lots of nuclei decaying in a short time. So the change in the number of nuclei per unit time is known as the activity. Different types of nuclei have different activities. The number of decays that you will get in a unit per time will depend on how many nuclei you have sitting in front of you. Okay, I mean, your probability of getting hit crossing a road is going to be proportional to the number of cars on the road. Okay, that's sort of the game. So that means that the activity, as I've written down at the bottom where I have a pink B circled, is equal to the number of decays per time, and that's proportional to the number of atoms in the sample, and that proportionality constant is known as the decay constant. The decay constant is in units of 1 over seconds. If you go to slide 15, the half-life is, I'm going to stop here, so let me forget slide 15. I'm going to rewrite it on slide 14, so you won't even have slide 15 available. I'm going to write the formula now for you on slide 14. The half-life is related to the decay constant by the equation that I write and circle in blue, and I will put a pink C and circle it beside the equation. The half-life and the decay constant are basically inversely related. If I have a long half-life, it means I'm going to have fewer decays per second because it will take longer before half of those nuclei have decayed. And the precise formula that relates the two is given where I have the pink C. And I think that now is a good place for me to stop. And we'll get back to this next Monday. So thanks for listening, and I hope you have a great weekend.